It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. This election season, Wisconsin Public Radio is meeting people where they are, in their communities, to talk about the issues that matter most to them. As part of our ongoing conversations about Beyond the Ballot, we look at how Wisconsinites are thinking about health care this election season. Is health care the single most important issue to you this election, and why? Do you feel like your elected officials represent you when it comes to health care? Why or why not? What's going on in your community regarding health care that nobody's talking about? Tell us your story. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address is ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Barbara Zubowa is a clinical assistant professor for the UW-Milwaukee College of Health Sciences Department of Health Services Administration. She also co-directs the university's Master of Health Administration program and owns the Center for Health and Wellness Law, LLC. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Bridget Bowden is special project reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. She's also project manager of Beyond the Ballot. Bridget, thanks again for being with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Bridget, today we're exploring health care. And while Beyond the Ballot isn't a scientific study, give us a sense of how much people are thinking about this issue. What do we know from those who have participated in Beyond the Ballot?
Right. So one of the questions we're asking as part of our Beyond the Ballot project is, what is the single most important issue to you this election season? And I've got to say, health care is either number one or number two as far as issues that people bring up. It's something that people care about in every corner of the state, and people of every political ideology, it's on their mind this election season.
Bridget, let's turn to how to Wisconsinites who are sharing their stories as part of Beyond the Ballot. Tell us about Atal Malik.
Yes, I brought some clips today. Our first is from Atal Malik, like you said. Atal is from Milwaukee, and he said healthcare is one of his most important issues this election season.
Well, I think it's important that everybody has affordable healthcare, especially with the times we're living in now. We have so many elders that are ill, and even young folks are falling ill these days. And I think everyone deserves affordable health care.
Barbara, Atal raises the point that he thinks everyone deserves affordable health care, but not everyone agrees. How is this an issue when we talk about the state of health care?
Right. So in the United States, we are the only country in the developed world that has not decided as a country, as a unified voice, that health care is a legal right. Other countries have stated that in various agreements, but the United States is unique in that it hasn't. And so I think at the core of Atal's statement is the recognition that we still are in a debate internally about whether health care should be a right or if it's something that's earned. So I think his comment is reflective of that continual debate.
Well, are there any laws on the books, Barbara, or is it anywhere in the Constitution that addresses this issue of health care being a right?
In the Constitution, no. So I think many people would be surprised to learn that our U.S. Constitution does not entitle anyone to health care, except under the Eighth Amendment, those who are in state custody do have the right to have their health care needs met. We do have a statute on the books called EMTALA that gives people the right to be treated, to be stabilized, if they walk into an emergency room, regardless of their ability to pay. But outside of that, there is no right to affordable health care, like Atal has commented.
Just for those who aren't familiar with the acronym EMTALA, it stands for the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, which is quite a mouthful. I'm talking with UW-Milwaukee's Barbara Zubowa and WPR News' Bridget Bowden, and we have space for you to join us. Do you feel like your elected officials represent you when it comes to health care? Why or why not? Can you tell us about a time when the government did something that helped you when it came to health care, or a time when the government did something that hurt you when it comes to health care? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings on Twitter. Bridget, the Affordable Care Act is something we're hearing about from listeners. Let's hear with a couple of them, starting with Dick Seideman.
Sure. Dick Seideman is from Sheboygan, and here's what he said when we asked him what his most important issue is this election season.
That is a very hard question. I'm looking at probably health care, and I think that's partly because of my age, but also because of the number of people that are, I'm going to say, young and middle-aged that are not covered by insurance. I was very unhappy to see what they've done to the Affordable Care Act.
And then let's also bring in Bob Morrison here, too. Bridget, how does he feel about the ACA and the state of health care overall?
So Bob is from West Bend, and he wants there to be a more affordable health care system, but he's really not sure what the solution is.
You know, I got a little concerned with President Obama's health care bill, how that was kind of going and how things are playing out there, because I still don't have a really good read on if it's good. I believe this should be health care for everybody, but how do we get to the point where it's all paid for and covered and not this socialized medicine they call out for, everything like that? So there's got to be ways. We're a country that should be able to figure out a way to take care of everybody. That's my opinion. You know, and I'm not so far against the quote single payer system. I mean, we pay taxes for Social Security and everything out. If we pay taxes for that, for our medical care to get treated, I think that's fine. The only problem I have is putting the government in charge of all that money.
There's a lot going on here when it comes to the Affordable Care Act, as we just heard from Dick and Bob. What are you watching now, Bridget, on the state of this law?
I think we should ask Barbara that question.
Oh, sorry. Barbara, what about it? What are we looking for on the state of the ACA?
Well, I think the pressing issue right now for the ACA is coming from the courts and not necessarily from Congress right now. Of course, that will depend on what happens in the midterm elections. But right now, there are there's a few cases, but there's two that I'm looking at closely. And one is in Texas and the other is in Maryland. And the Texas case, it's called Texas versus the United States. And Texas, along with 30-some other states, including Wisconsin, so our attorney general, who's up for reelection, joined this lawsuit that was filed back in June to basically say because President Trump's tax reform bill that was signed into law last December got rid of the tax, for people who don't have health insurance. So now, under the new law, tax law, people who don't have health insurance don't have to pay a fine starting next year. Because that has gone away under the law, the Texas lawsuit, including our attorney general, are arguing that the rest of the law, especially the provisions that protect people with pre-existing conditions, should also disappear. And so that lawsuit, it could undermine the Affordable Care Act even further by getting rid of a very popular protection for people with pre-existing conditions. The Maryland lawsuit came a week after there was oral argument in the Texas lawsuit, and the state of Maryland's attorney general is suing the government for not enforcing the Affordable Care Act and arguing that just because that tax has now disappeared, it doesn't mean that pre-existing condition protection should disappear.
We're going to continue our conversation about how health care is on the minds of voters in just a moment. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. On this installment of Beyond the Ballot, we're talking about how we feel about health care in Wisconsin. How do you feel? Tell us about a time when the government did something that helped you or hurt you when it came to health care. What's going on in your community regarding health care? What kinds of discussions are we having? And what are some things that nobody's talking about? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. The email address, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Barbara Zaboa is a clinical assistant professor for UW-Milwaukee College of Health Services, and Bridget Bowden is WPR's special projects reporter. But before we dive back into this issue, a quick program note. Tune into WPR Tuesday night, November 6th, for live election coverage. NPR reports on national races starting at 7, when polls in Wisconsin close at 8. Sean Johnson, Frederica Freiberg, and Rob Ferret anchor WPR's coverage of statewide elections, including the races for governor and U.S. senator. Bridget, let's turn to Crystal Zimmerman, another Wisconsinite who shared her story as part of the Beyond the Ballot project. What did she have to say?
So we talked to some people who are very much in favor of the things that the government has done recently in terms of healthcare policy. But Crystal Zimmerman of Beloit disagrees with many of those things. So let's take a listen to what she has to say.
Having worked in healthcare, the government has done some things that have made healthcare more expensive, and I'm not in favor of some of the ways that government has kind of forced hospitals and healthcare institutions into electronic medical records and all sorts of different certifications and, just things that keep increasing the cost of healthcare, but it is not directly beneficial to the patient.
Barbara, how do rising costs for healthcare play into this conversation?
Well, it's a huge concern for a lot of people, not just, consumers, but for people who are in the industry, other, stakeholders. It's an enormous problem. Healthcare is about 18% of our gross domestic product. That means we spend 18% of all the dollars in the United States on healthcare, which leaves little, less money for spending on education and, the environment and other types of public goods. So it's a huge concern, and I agree with Crystal that there's a lot of red tape in healthcare. There's a lot of different sides to each of those issues, and because we do have so many stakeholders in the system who aren't always at agreement with each other on how we should spend the money.
Let's take a phone call. Let's go to Jean in Lake Mills. Jean, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
So my question is, my son's pay actually went up, which was a wonderful thing, from $11 an hour to $15 an hour. Because his income was so low, his rent was so much, I've been helping him pay his health care through, the plans on healthcare.gov since all of the Obamacare started, and has been very grateful that we've been able to have something affordable. But I have seen the difference and calling them in a plan for someone making $11 an hour and some making even a dollar or two more per hour. So I've literally been scared to death to even call, because I help him on that end too, to ask to get the rate corrected for what he makes now. Because I know even between the two of us, we probably won't be able to afford it. It'll probably jump $300 or $400 a month. So what I'm wondering is, the mandate has gone away for people to have health care. Is there anything, are we going to get hit with a tremendously large bill for underpayment? I mean, last year, even though we did everything totally by the line, we ended up with a $359 underpayment bill at the end of the year, which then he got harassed for the last 2 months about not paying, even though we had. It took 2 months to prove it, and they were trying to tell me he had to pay it or get fined and all this stuff. He just got a letter yesterday saying that was straight cleaned up. So I'm scared next year we're going to have one for $1,500 or something.
Gina, thanks for sharing that story. Bridget, affordability definitely on the mind of Wisconsinites. Tell us about Rebecca Olson's take on this part of the issue.
Right. Rebecca is from Menominee. And again, when we asked her what her top issue is this election season, here's what she said.
Healthcare is probably a big one for me, because it's really not very affordable to middle-class families. We definitely, we fought with an insurance company to get medical care that was very necessary to be paid for, and it was not paid for. We had to fight all the way to the end to finally get it paid for by a secondary insurance company. And it was really nerve-wracking for the whole family because the person who needed the care almost lost it. And then in the last minute, they were able to get the care. But the whole time, it was very stressful.
And Rebecca and our caller, Jean, aren't the only ones thinking about how expensive health care is. Bridget, let's bring Rhonda Olson in here, too.
Right. Rhonda Olson is from Eau Claire, and she actually works in the healthcare field. And she also is concerned about the cost and thinks it needs to change.
I see a lot of people who can't afford their medications, who can't afford treatment, who cannot see physicians because they have inadequate coverage or no coverage at all. And then their health suffers, and they end up paying more in the long run.
Barbara, what's your reaction to all of this? Jean's issue with her son's health insurance going up and having to make payments on more, and worried that without the mandates that her son's insurance bill is going to skyrocket, and then the two people that we heard from here as well. What's your reaction about all the costs associated with health care, and how is that affecting the way we think about this issue?
Yeah, I think healthcare costs are top of mind, as demonstrated by the callers from the show. And, the Affordable Care Act tried to find a happy medium with costs. So there were winners and losers when it came to cost. There were people who had pre-existing conditions who didn't have coverage before, who now, because of the Affordable Care Act, have coverage that costs them less than it would have otherwise because of those pre-existing conditions. And those people who don't have pre-existing conditions because of the Affordable Care Act now probably pay more than they otherwise have because of this community rating provision under the Affordable Care Act. And, the caller was right that if her son decides not to have health insurance, next year he wouldn't have to pay a penalty for not having health insurance. But, it's not ever a good idea to go without health insurance because it is so costly. And unfortunately, it's costly because consumers are really insulated from the care because of insurance. Without the government having to step in and really controlling prices, these costs are kind of increasing unabated, and it's a really tough issue.
Let's take another call. Susan is with us in La Crescent, Minnesota. Susan, good morning. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I probably should have mentioned that I'm a mental health therapist. I work in La Crosse, Wisconsin, so all my clients come from Wisconsin. But anyhow, I work with severely mentally ill clients, and the therapy that I do gets them better so they can go to work. And unfortunately, a lot of times when they start working, they make too much money, and then they get cut off, like Badger Care and stuff like that. So then they can't afford the mental health care, which is stabilizing them so that they can remain in their job. So it ends up being kind of a cycle where they literally have to stop working or greatly reduce their hours in order to maintain the health insurance, but yet then they can't pay their rent. And, so it's just this infinite feedback loop that they get stuck in.
Susan, thanks for sharing that. Barbara, it sounds like there are a lot of Catch-22 examples here, including the one that Susan cites about getting mental health, and that's an issue we haven't talked about. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time to discuss it. Do you think that we're ever going to do anything about this?
I'm hopeful that we will, and I use the example of pre-existing conditions as evidence that people from all sides of the political aisle can come together and in a unified voice say, we want protections in health care. And pre-existing conditions was one of those protections that Republicans, independents, and Democrats and the majority of whom agree that those protections should be in place. And so I think with enough education and advocacy by the different stakeholders in healthcare, we can come to a consensus that mental health care and health care generally should be something okay. everybody has access to.
Barbara, thank you. Bridget, if people want to share what they're thinking about regarding health care this election season, quickly, how can they get involved?
They can call us at 877-782-8942. And if you've tried to call that number in the past and it hasn't worked, we have fixed that problem. So that's 877-782-8942.
Okay. Bridget Bowden is a special project reporter at WPR and also project manager for Beyond the Ballot. Barbara Zubowa is a clinical assistant professor for the UW-Milwaukee College of Health Sciences. Thank you to both of you. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The most recent spate of political killings in America has us wondering about the connection between these crimes and the increasingly strident partisan rhetoric coming at us from almost every direction. What was your reaction to the violence we've seen over the past few weeks? Do you think that our political rhetoric and polarization have contributed to it? What do you think should be done to stop political violence and hate crimes? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Scott Strauss is the Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Political Science and International Studies at UW-Madison. He specializes in genocide, political violence, human rights, and African politics. Scott, welcome to the program. Appreciate you being here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
In the span of 1 week, we saw three politically or maybe they were ideologically motivated crimes. There was the killing of two black senior citizens at a grocery store in Kentucky after the perpetrator had attempted to forcibly enter a black church, the shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh, the attempted mail bombing of 12 prominent Democrats and one cable television network, CNN. So, Scott, how should we contextualize or understand these incidents? What's the common thread, if there is one here?
Well, I think at a minimum, it's extremely worrisome. I mean, anytime someone murders someone else for political reasons in these ways, it's obviously incredibly worrisome and scary. I think, you know, it's probably worth making distinctions among some of these incidents. I think the one that happened at the synagogue was clearly driven by anti-Semitism and anti-immigration sentiment. I think the one that happened, you know, the sort of mail bombings were clearly partisan in their targets. I know a little bit less about what happened in Kentucky, but I think that seems to be motivated by more anti-black racial violence. But I think all of these are signs of, you know, a kind of apocalyptic sentiment among some members of the American public and, you know, a sense of deep foreboding that is driving some people to violence.
As I look at some of these and read the accounts, I don't know, I'm thinking that there might be a difference between politically motivated and ideologically motivated crimes. Is that a distinction that's fair to draw, or is it maybe not even useful?
You know, I probably wouldn't draw too much of a distinction. I think that these are acts of violence. Certainly what happened in Pittsburgh and the pipe bombs are clearly political in nature, in the sense that they are seem to be for political purpose. They're trying to change politics. They're trying to take people taking action in their own hands. The perpetrators or the alleged perpetrators fall on the spectrum of the right. But I don't know how useful it is to think about this as, you know, principally ideology driving this.
So what qualifies something as political violence?
I think it's the deliberate infliction of harm for a political purpose, you know, very simply. And most people would think about, you know, it gets attention when someone is murdered or when it's lethal violence. I mean, that's what people typically mean by political violence.
So at what point do we need to draw a parallel between these incidents and what we call terrorism?
I think terrorism is an apt term particularly to describe, you know, the events in Pittsburgh and what happened with the mail bombings. I mean, terrorism, classically defined, is the use of violence against a civilian for a political purpose in order to send a message, and committed by an individual or a non-state organization. And I think in these cases, you look at what happened in Pittsburgh at the synagogue, I think that this was attacks against civilians. This was for a political purpose. It was seems to be designed to send a message, and it was committed by an individual. We don't have an organization behind these, behind these perpetrators, as far as I know. I think in terrorism studies, people would think of this as so-called lone wolf attacks, where you have individuals that seem to be radicalized and who are inspired by some, a set of ideas and take action into their own hands. But I think terrorism is an appropriate label for what happened.
So you mentioned lone wolf acts of violence. These things don't happen in a vacuum. So what else is going on here?
Yeah, I think we should all be asking ourselves that question. I mean, how could this happen, and what is this revealing about our society right now? And I think at the same time, we don't want to jump to conclusions about exactly what motivated these individuals. But that said, I think we can, fairly surmise that they are drawing from the broader political environment, and they are drawing from ideas that they're gaining access to online or in the public space. And those ideas are either reinforcing or enhancing or enabling or legitimizing their views. And I think that's what should give us all pause. And I think that it's really important right now for anyone in public office or anyone who's in the media or anyone who has a public role to exercise tremendous care and caution in the language that they use.
And then thinking about in those societies where terrorism is present and active, and unfortunately ours seems to be one of them, are there some commonalities? Are there some common traits across those societies?
Yes and no. I think you can see commonalities among some of the individuals. I mean, the sort of typical process of radicalization would be that you have an individual who is sort of alienated or humiliated, has a sense of victimization, and then latches on to a set of ideas and a belonging to a group and subscribing to a particular ideology or ideas, and thinking that there's going to be salvation in acting on those ideas and taking matters into their own hands. And so I think, from what I know, and I think there's still a lot to learn here, I think that pattern seems to fit what happened recently in the United States, unfortunately. I think that, beyond that, it's hard to say. I mean, you see terrorism in the context of civil war. You see it in authoritarian countries. You see it in democratic countries. You see it in higher-income countries. You see it in lower-income countries. So I think in terms of the kind of countries in which it happens, as far as I know, there's not a clear answer to, is there a particular country in which it occurs?
Scott Strauss is the Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Political Science and International Studies at UW-Madison, and we're talking about political violence in America and where it's coming from and what might be done about it. Wondering what you think about all of this. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Join our conversation. You've mentioned terrorism and radicalization. Those are terms that we probably didn't even think about 30, 40 years ago. I mean, and yet now they have become common in discussions about these issues. Any thoughts on kind of how we progressed to this point where we have people being radicalized and feeling empowered to actually take action and commit violence against their fellow human beings?
I think that's the right question to be asking, and I certainly don't have all of the answers. I think that, there is a current in American politics today that strikes me as extremely dangerous. And what we're seeing through these incidents is that there are people with deeply bigoted views who are having their ideas reinforced online or reinforced in the public sphere, and are feeling emboldened to act. I don't think we're at an epidemic level. I think these incidents happen together and they're drawing our attention to them, but I think it's very worrisome and very scary. And it should be a real wake-up call. To answer your question, I think that I don't think there's a clear reason why we're in this position and why terrorism has become a more common parlance, certainly after 9/11 in the United States. I think that particular incident drew a lot of attention in the United States to terrorism, but if you were to go around the world, whether it be Israel, whether it be the United Kingdom or other places, Sri Lanka, that there are longer histories of terrorism where these ideas and these concepts were more present than in the United States.
It seems like both Cesar Sayoc and Robert Bowers were influenced by ideas they got in online communities. Should we be concerned about that? I mean, are there ways to curb that kind of speech? And is that even something we could consider?
I think we should be concerned about it for sure. And I think one of the things that seems true about the social networks is that they tend to increase polarization. They tend to reinforce views. They allow people to, to sort of develop extreme ideas and feel as if they are validated in those ideas by finding other people online. The question of how you control them is a really difficult one. I think you're seeing some of the larger social media companies like Facebook and Twitter who are getting more, I'd say, aggressive in the way in which they are trying to clamp down on hate speech or speech or postings that would incite violence or that are deliberately false information. At the same time, I think you have to be really careful about, you don't want these companies to be the grand arbiters of speech in the United States, which has a very long history of supporting free and open dialogue and speech. And I think they're in a tough spot. I think that the reason why a term like terrorism, I think, can be helpful in this context is that I think it points us to the seriousness of the issue, and I think that it would, I think, prompt more resources and attention to the kind of hateful and violent rhetoric that's happening in some of the dark corners of the web. And again, I think these incidents should be a wake-up call for all of us that this is happening.
Our conversation about political violence continues. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Scott Strauss is the Violence Distinguished Achievement Professor of Political Science and International Studies at UW-Madison. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The most recent spate of political killings in America has us wondering about the connection between these crimes and the increasingly strident partisan rhetoric coming at us from every direction. What's your reaction to the violence we've seen over the past few weeks? Do you think our political rhetoric and polarization have contributed to it? And what do you think should be done to stop this political violence and these hate crimes? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Scott Strauss is with us in this segment. He's a Violence Distinguished Achievement Professor of Political Science and International Studies at UW-Madison. His studies specialize in genocide, political violence, human rights, and African politics. Let's take a phone call. Tom joins us from the top of Wisconsin up in Port Wing. Tom, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Well, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I want to say that extreme negative reporting, which we've seen probably for the first time in the last 2 years, we have TV, radio, and newsprint that can't say anything good about the current administration. This constant smack talk is what is driving a lot of it. And a lot of the people in the media, they don't see it. I think if I asked Wisconsin Public Radio in the last 6 months, can you give me at least six stories that were positive about this administration? They would not be able to do it because there's this extreme negative reporting and talk. And you can't talk bad about your neighbor every day and then 2 months later be shocked when somebody does something extreme.
Okay, Tom, we get it. The media is pushing a lot of this negative information. Many people have pointed to today's intense partisanship and political rhetoric as factors that have fueled people like Cesar Sayoc and Robert Bowers. Before we have our guest respond, Tom, to you, I want to hear from Vice President Mike Pence responding to that sentiment on NBC.
Frankly, people on both sides of the aisle use strong language about our political differences, but I just don't think you can connect it to threats or acts of violence, and I don't think the American people connect it.
Scott, negative things on the news about the Trump administration, political rhetoric, how do they play into the political violence that we're seeing? The vice president doesn't think there's a connection there.
Yeah, look, I think Tom's call is really important. I think that we have very deep polarization in the United States, and that is strongly coloring the institutions that, you know, that ground our democracy, whether that be the media, whether that be political institutions, whether that be courts. And I think you find on both sides that, you know, that everyone thinks the other side is, you know, the media is extremely biased. If you talk to someone who is liberal, they will point to Fox News. You know, Tom, I think, is pointing to WPR or other kinds of media that are anti-Trump. I think, you know, I don't know whether or not there, you know, one station is heavily biased in a political direction. But what I would say is that this kind of distrust in our institutions is very dangerous. And I think it's really important that, you know, views like Tom's are aired and we have a conversation about these things. I think what we're seeing in the media is that again, people who have particular views are drawn to particular stations, and then their ideas are reinforced by those. And I think that's, you know, that's, again, I think of concern for having a dialogue about, as Americans, about what we want for our country.
Do we know whether there's a connection between inflammatory political rhetoric and political violence?
Yeah, I think one has to always be cautious about drawing a causal connection. I mean, I think we don't know exactly what inspired these individuals. We don't know whether or not it was a neo-Nazi online. We don't know whether or not it was, you know, if it was President Trump and his discussion of the caravans. I think we just don't know. And I think even in the literature, this relationship between political speech and acts of violence is a little bit unclear. I think what we can say is that in the aftermath of these kinds of incidents, we should exercise, politicians, everyone, people in the media, should exercise, you know, I think, real caution in the language that they use, and make it very clear that they don't condone these things and they don't want their speech in any way to inspire or reinforce or, you know, or enable those who would commit these acts of violence.
But we hear politicians using so-called dog whistle language. So even when it sounds like they're being reasonable, it's almost like there's a wink and a nudge toward people with radical views. President Trump was talking about globalists, and that's kind of a dog whistle toward the conspiracy theory that says, for example, that the Jews control the entire financial system. Don't we need to push back against that a little bit? And the president saying he's a nationalist.
Yeah, I think we do. I mean, I think that we, you know, I think the president can be careless in the language he uses, and I think the kinds of things that he says or the gestures that he makes can inspire fringe groups, can reinforce their views, or they also could alienate them. I mean, I don't think we know. And people can be inspired to violence because they think the president is not radical enough and is not doing enough. So I think we have to be cautious about making causal connections. But again, I think it's it is incumbent upon our elected officials to make sure that they don't use language or use gestures or imply that there are Jews behind everything that happens, that it's, you know, the language I think of invasion and assault on our country is inflammatory. And I think that's, you know, I would, if I were advising President Trump, I would tell him to stop.
So Robert Bowers was motivated in part by the white nationalist idea of white genocide. What is that?
It's this perception that white culture and the white race are under threat and under assault in the United States and elsewhere. And, you know, I think one of the things that we see that's common across these acts of extreme violence is that people often feel that they are taking action to protect themselves, protect their nation, protect their community. And from everything that I've seen from Robert Bowers, he seems to have been in that mode, you know, that he was you know, protecting his race and protecting his community. And I think the sense of danger, of threat, is often a motivator for violence.
How do other countries around the world view political violence in the U.S., like the incidents that we've been discussing?
Yeah, I think that there is a sense that in the United States, there, you know, these sort of mass shootings and lax gun controls are a particularly American phenomenon. And that said, there are certainly many incidents of political violence around the world, and clearly acts of terrorism as well. And it's not just in the United States. If you think about what happened in Norway with Anders Breivik, and other places, whether it be the United Kingdom or in France, there are certainly other acts of political violence that happen in industrialized democratic countries. I think the way people see the United States, fairly or unfairly, is that it is a place where it's very easy to get access to guns, and that contributes to a culture of violence in the United States.
And you know what? We're out of time. We could continue this discussion for at least another hour. Scott, thank you so much for spending this time with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Strauss is the Violence Distinguished Achievement Professor of Political Science and International Studies at UW-Madison. His studies specialize in genocide, political violence, human rights, and African politics. His most recent book is Making and Unmaking Nations, War, Leadership, and Genocide in Modern Africa. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.